Good evening. You've probably all heard this teaching that everything is perfect just as it is. You heard that teaching? This teaching comes to my mind very often. Some might treat it as a sort of koan, but I don't use that word very much. Because it's a teaching, it is medicine. And because it's medicine, it matters how it's administered and taken. There are many things in our world that don't look so good. In any of our communities and our immediate lives, there are many occasions for suffering for ourselves and for others. And it's not quite right to allow the teaching of everything's perfect just as it is to obscure that suffering. Today I was studying some of our literature. I ran across a remark by Suzuki Roshi's teacher, Gyokujin Roshi, who told him, even though it doesn't help, you should study for lecture. So I too forced myself to study for lecture. The Buddhas see our suffering world as perfect as it is. And yet they are constantly emerging in our world and extending us a hand to lead beings out of suffering. So the paradox there is that in the face of this, the great perfection of everything, we have some tremendous responsibility. Which can manifest itself in countless great and small ways in the course of a day. The other day I was in my neighborhood and as is often the case, there was someone asking for money, and he was a youngish man with a little dog. And so I gave him a little money, and he burst into tears. Doesn't usually happen, but I gathered that he had been having a difficult time. And in the face of this great perfection, we somehow keep allowing each other to wind up in states of woe, as though there were no choice about that. And to some extent, I'm afraid we're imprisoned by our kind of intellectual and religious heritage, which can teach that if you're not prosperous and successful, it's because you're a bad person. And I think sometimes this has infected our view, so that the presence in our world of so many people who don't have enough is met with the response, well, that's just how it is, you know. Too bad. Some people even use Jesus's remark about what does he say? The poor you always will have with you. As though that meant, oh, don't bother anything. You're not doing anything about that. They'll always be around. It's like, no, that's not what he meant. I would say he meant that they will always be our responsibility. And yet somehow it's a little difficult to see a great deal of progress on that front. Maybe in the U.S. you could say there's some, but worldwide, not so much. Still, to be able to look out upon that world and feel our own ascent to that teaching that everything is perfect just as it is pretty important. Because without that, we can get very out of balance. And so to witness the world in that way is to witness the world with, you might say, Zazen mind. And that is the mind, the body-mind, as it is right now. Suzuki Roshi, and one of his lectures says, He says, you know, when Buddha should be sad, Buddha should be sad. And when Buddha should be happy, Buddha should be happy. And sometimes even Buddha is angry. But those responses are very much in the rhythm of the circumstances as they are unfolding. So I don't think it's accurate to say that Buddha witnesses the suffering of the world and is indifferent. And I realize that maybe sometimes people think that that is so. But there is a tremendous difference between indifference and equanimity. Those are not the same things. So, in Buddha's response to what he or she or they see and experience in the world is part of that great perfection. And that great perfection is, how do we say, is each of us, each of you, is a reflection of it. So it is not a state of mind that you acquire. It's the profound truth of things as they are, moment after moment after moment. And that invites and includes our response. Sometimes that response might be to be angry. But if so, again, that anger needs to be part of the resonant truth of what's happening. And should not become a an obscuration. And for Buddhas, of course, it does not. So a lot of our teaching is about the mind of Zazen, and it's invariably described in poetry. There are no, as far as I know, there are no reliable clinical descriptions of the mind of Zazen. But instead, there are poems that have the resonance of that mind the way a bell sounds when you ring it. So our poems say things like, fire heats, wind moves, water wets, earth is solid, eye and sights, ear and sounds, nose and smells, tongue and tastes. With each and every thing, depending on the roots, the leaves spread forth. And this is a profound description of the perfect function of the body-mind. And we return to our practice of sitting over and over again so that that sound, that smell, that taste, that touch becomes very, very familiar. And we trust it with our whole body-mind. In that way, we are, as much as possible, we are moving with the integrity of whatever the situation is as it's unfolding. Moving with the perfection of things as they are. And as circumstances dictate, moving to take care of what's in front of us. I was reflecting on those lines about fire, air, earth, and water, and so forth. And another line came to my mind, although it's from another poem. And that line is, the whole process must return to the source. My teacher sometimes speaks of our experience as a complete circuit. The functioning, the generation of karma is based on short circuits or partial circuits, such that what we encounter seems to us to be separate from us. People we encounter are other than ourselves. And we have our experience in here, and then there's things and people out there. And they never meet. And these are partial circuits, and they generate karma. But a complete circuit does not. The line, the whole process must return to the source, reminds us of this. Sometimes when we're in our sitting practice, maybe we may sometimes have the sense that whatever is unfolding sights for the eye or sounds for the ear and so forth, somehow is unfolding in here. I was at the monastery, and the training period was being led by Ed Brown, whom some of you know. And he was saying, I think this was in the spring, and the birds were very active. And he said sometimes when he was eating meals in the zendo with the Oryoki, he said it would seem to him that the birds were coming out of his, bird song was coming out of his bowls. I appreciated that pointer. And things can seem that way sometimes. So to be reminded, the whole process must return to the source. We're being told also the whole process does return to the source over and over again. And the original arising of things is here. And one way that the Buddhas taught us to respond to the powerful teaching of things are perfect just as they are, one way is to bring forward the Bodhisattva vow. So there's recognizing the great perfection, and then there's responding with the vow to lead all beings away from the states of woe. And sometimes people who, you know, they hear about the Bodhisattva vow and that way of living, and they would like to they want to say something about that commitment, about their commitment. So we have little ceremonies sometimes that we do. And people in that ceremony, they talk about how they want their lives to be and what their dedication is. And then sometimes they'll wear a little symbol or reminder by donning a certain article of clothing. That's great. It's not essential, but sometimes that's an encouraging thing to do. So that's open to anyone. So I think I will, you know, I'm going to keep coming back to this teaching, or maybe this teaching will keep coming back to me over and over again. How is it that everything is perfect just as it is? And how do I respond in the midst of that? I know, I've, I think I told you that story. The second abbot of Zen Center was visiting down in Carmel Valley, and he was on his way into the monastery, and he was at the little house at the beginning of the road there, and Reverend Lou Hartman, who died not so long ago, some of you know, he was reading the newspaper, and there had been some disaster or other, maybe a terrible plane crash. And he was reading the newspaper, and he looked at this article, and he said, Lou Hartman said aloud, and he said, "That's really terrible." And Reverend Zentatsu, the abbot, looked over his shoulder at the article, and he said, "Oh, it doesn't matter." And Reverend Hartman turned around and looked at him and said, "That's really terrible." And the abbot said, "Not if it really doesn't matter." That's a story about things are perfect just as they are, and yet something must be done. Would you like to ask some questions?
Could you say a little more about the short circuit?
And the long circuit.
The short circuits are the ones that are interrupted by the misknowledge that self and other are separate. Those are short circuits. Complete circuits, self and other are one phenomenon. And those, as I say, don't generate karma. Short circuits do.
Why is that? Open up as a circuit, or those open up?
I don't know. You have to ask Reverend Ten Shin about that. But that was his expression. And it kind of makes sense.
But you raised it.
I think you raised it in the context of everything returning to the source.
Okay.
It's electricity.
Can you rephrase your question?
What is it that returns to the source that's everything, and what's the difference between the source and what returns to the source?
Well, I don't think I venture into saying what's the difference. The whole process must return to the source is an invitation to the complete circuits. That's all. So in other words, if we are cramped by our misknowledge that self and other are separate, we can, so to speak, return to the source by dropping that and allowing the circuit to complete. And in so doing, the tendency to generate what in Sanskrit is called karma nishanda, which is the karma that flows into the future, is interrupted. This is a somewhat technical discussion, but that's what they say.
So I appreciate, and if I understand what you're saying, the emphasis on the perfection of the moment is, I guess, realized in the response to the moment. And I was just remembering when my 14-year-old nephew died of an asthma attack, and my sister-in-law and brother-in-law were obviously devastated, and I was in my home, and I knew I should call her, and I was overcome with dread and anxiety, and I finally dialed the number, and as soon as I heard her voice, everything dropped away. Mm-hmm. And it was like we were together in that moment, and I was fully there, and she was there, and that's all that mattered.
Yeah.
Okay. So, might returning to the source be the appropriate when there's a return, an appropriate response?
Well, the whole process always returns to the source. So the realization of that may or may not produce a response that is visible to others or to oneself. So it's not doesn't hinge on the response exactly. It's more like see and understand in this body mind that the whole process does return to the source. Always. It must. Yeah.
Oscar, could I? I'm struggling with what this source business is. Is it everything as perfect as it is?
The short circuiting, you describe that the basis for that short circuiting as failure to recognize the lack of separation between self and other.
It's misknowledge, it's sometimes called.
And I have a lot of that misknowledge.
Yeah, so do we all.
But sometimes, and if I have to use words to characterize those points in time where I feel that there is no separation between self and other would be on the cushion.
Right.
When you just let everything drop away.
Yeah, but the critical teaching is that this misknowledge is just that. It is misknowledge, and Buddhas have taught it's not so. So, all right, well, drop it then. Drop the misknowledge.
Okay.
And it doesn't, that doesn't mean you're going to feel a certain way. It's like, oh, I dropped the misknowledge. Now I'm floating through the universe on a pink lotus or something like that.
That's exactly what I was going to lead towards,
the
which
pink
is...
lotus?
What's that?
The pink lotus?
No.
No.
No. The you know, as you moved your arms around, so it as if to indicate a particular state of mind.
Right.
So.
Yeah, don't get caught up in that.
Don't get caught up in that.
No. To remember Buddha's teaching about this misknowledge is already a tremendous step. Whatever it may feel like in a particular moment. So if we wait for a particular sensation or group of sensations that we can look at or experience and say, oh, that's it. This is what it feels like when all of that misknowledge drops away and I feel really great, then we're actually limiting our experience.
I have a lot more work to do.
Well, sure, but you know, that's what we're here for.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Miya-san, if I may restate what I think I've heard or what I understand you to be saying. When we fail to recognize that self and other are not different.
Not two.
Right, are not two. Mm-hmm. This is a misperception of reality as it is. Misperception leads to inappropriate action, which in turn causes suffering.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it. So, you've all received this teaching, though, about what constitutes the misknowledge. And that is critically important. And the Tibetans would say, the fact that you even heard that teaching means you have tremendous roots of practice. Otherwise, you could not hear it. You could not even be in this room. So, congratulations, and you know, keep that ball rolling, if you like. So don't get hung up in thinking, oh my God, I've got so much terrible karma to deal with, because you're already riding a tremendous wave of awakening. So, you know, don't get hung up on trying to catalog all of the difficult work you've got to do to get rid of all of your terrible delusions, etc., etc. That's not going to be helpful. Mm-hmm.
So I have grave concerns when the response to a tragic incident that claimed the lives of certain people, and the response was it doesn't matter. And
yeah, me too.
And but I think there's something deeper than, because it doesn't matter doesn't mean that something matters or that what matters doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. I think it means something in regards to the life that is imperfect and that is impermanent. And so when something happens that claims the lives of people, it doesn't matter because
of the great perfection. Because of the great perfection. And I think that's probably what Reverend Santatsu meant by it doesn't matter, because of the vast perfection. But again, that doesn't mean there's nothing to be done. And that doesn't mean I don't cry at funerals, because I do. Sometimes sad Buddha, sometimes happy Buddha.
I was reflecting on, you know, Dora Lee's story, and you know, that time when we have to have a difficult conversation, and we feel, you know, anxiety about that and dread, and it's hard not to short circuit with that kind of feeling, mm-hmm. you know, that's arising, you know, mm-hmm. in us. And, you know, so, you know, that's kind of, you know, part of, you know, complete is like, wow, look at, you know, this difficult conversation that I have to make, and this anxiety that I feel, and then this comes up a lot, you know.
And then the hand goes out to the telephone.
Yeah.
In the midst of that.
Yeah, in the midst of that. Right. But taking care of that too, mm-hmm. right? I mean, really taking care of that.
Yeah.
And not short-circuiting that.
Not short-circuiting it or denying it.
Yeah.
Or praying that it weren't so, or hating it.
It shouldn't be like this.
Shouldn't be like that. That's all a waste of time.
Yeah. Trying to escape.
Yeah.
That seems like the real work to me.
Yeah. That too is real work.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe that's enough for now, unless Happy New Year to everyone.
Yes. Happy New Year.
It's good to see you again. Thank you very much.